You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Let me begin by welcoming you to the panel discussion on cloud computing. We have five very distinguished participants in this discussion. We're going to try to go through opening comments from each of them and then have some time for questions between the panelists and then go to questions from the floor. So my name is Roger Cochetti. I'm with RJC Associates. We provide advisory services on e-commerce matters to clients interested in internet and related e-commerce issues, and very pleased to be the moderator for this panel discussion. Let me briefly introduce the five speakers and then talk a little bit about the subject, and we'll get right into the discussion. Derek Wyatt is a member of Parliament from the United Kingdom. He's been a member of Parliament since 1997, has considerable business experience, and floated one company on the AIM and raised £8 million for another. He co-chairs the All-Party Communications Group and founded the Oxford Internet Institute. We're going to go down the table, beginning with Derek, who is at my far left, your far right, and work our way down the table. His right is Susie Adams. Susie is the Chief Technology Officer for Microsoft's federal civilian business. She oversees and implements the technical strategy for Microsoft's IGO, finance, land management, and civilian agency federal government business. Prior to joining Microsoft, she held numerous leadership positions at the Washington, D.C. area consulting organizations, including McGlattery and Pullen, Booz Allen Hamilton, and Financial Dynamics. Next to her is Jim Dempsey. Jim is the Vice President for Public Policy at the Center for Democracy and Technology and head of CDT West. Jim coordinates the Digital Privacy and Security Working Group, affectionately called DIPSWIG, a forum where companies, trade associations, and privacy advocates discuss issues of government surveillance, privacy, and cybersecurity. For over a year, DIPSWIG has been focused on the issues associated with cloud computing. Charles Davidson is to Jim's right. Charles is the director of the Advanced Communications Law and Policy Institute of New York Law School. Prior to joining the institute, Chuck served as a commissioner on the Florida Public Service Commission, the regulatory agency that oversees the state's telecommunications, energy, and water industries. Last and immediately to my left, Harry Wingo is a policy counsel in Google's Washington, D.C. office. In his present role, he focuses on cybersecurity and energy policy for Google. Prior to joining Microsoft, he was vice president of government and regulatory affairs at Current Group, a smart grid company. Each of the panelists will spend a few minutes making opening remarks. One of the challenging things about the panel discussion we're about to enter is defining the topic of cloud computing. Cloud computing is a term that describes the dynamic remote storage, sharing, and processing of data on a worldwide basis. While this has happened since the introduction of commercial mainframe computer services in the 1950s, over the past decade, and particularly with the growth of web-based services, this approach to computing has grown enormously, particularly among individual consumers. The remote storage of important and trivial data on the web has become nearly pervasive among internet users, with only a little attention to the public policy implications of this development. In today's
one-hour program, we cannot possibly address all of the policy issues raised by the global growth of cloud computing. Instead, I've asked the panel to comment on, among other things, the policy and regulatory implications of the dynamic storage, sharing, and processing of consumers' personally identifiable information by domestic web-based service providers. This, I believe, is the tip of the spear of the public policy debate, certainly of the debate within the Congressional Internet Caucus. Those of you who follow this topic know that this leaves to another discussion some enormously important issues, not least of which are the international provision of such services, the provision of such services to enterprise as opposed to individual consumer clients, and the provision of such services to consumers when non-personally identifiable information is being stored, shared, and processed. And finally, at the risk of stating the obvious, for those who have not followed this topic or haven't thought about it, I assume that nearly everyone in this room understands that in this topic, we are discussing, whether we use the term cloud computing to describe it or not, such things as the storage on web servers of our emails, our bank records, our travel reservations, our mileage club records, our investment records, our family photos, our health information, our academic records, our insurance records, our social information, our creative works, and much, much more. It's difficult to find a subject that is more important to the average American than the storage of this much information in the cloud. With that, let me ask Derek to begin our comments and remind each of the panelists that you've got 3 or 4 minutes for opening comments, and if you hear me tapping the microphone, it means that you're exceeding your time so that others will have time. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Good morning, everyone. I think there are a couple of questions, really, that I hope we all feel are the questions we would want if we are citizens. To be answered, not necessarily today, but which are going to be teased out over the next year or two. The first one is, whose intellectual property is it? Now, it seems to me that I have given away my IP without knowing. And so, as a citizen, I would like to row back to, well, wait a minute. I wasn't aware that when I signed that or when I agreed that 28,000 pages that was on the net that I had to Twitter to or had to Facebook, that I just said I agree, because I couldn't be bothered to read it, is acceptable. And I would like, as a citizen, to know where my intellectual property is currently before we even get into this huge debate about cloud computing, because if you can't define that for me, I feel uneasy. And so let's park that for the moment, because I think this is what we are talking about. States are going to use, and commerce is using currently, our intellectual property without always our authority. And I value my intellectual property, and I would like to see much greater safeguards. But park that argument. I think there are three issues: IP rights, there's data protection for those rights on my behalf, and there's jurisdiction. Now, you may be moving faster in your country. Our government has a cloud computing strategy, and that will be finessed over the next 18 months. It will become into the public domain, and there will be slight discussion because it's such, for most citizens, to be honest, they're not that interested. But for those that are, it will be a very stimulating 18 months as this policy gets into the public domain. So I think for me, it's IP rights, data protection, and jurisdiction. I'm sure some of the panelists will go through some of those issues. My challenge to you this morning is this. We spent a good part of the first 50 years of the United Nations trying to work out what human rights were and whether there was something that was called the international human rights. And that's the issue, I guess, that President Obama said to the students in Beijing and Shanghai when he engaged in those conversations, something that's been more painful in the last 2 weeks when you look at the Google issues that they have had, but not just Google. So my challenge is this. Is the human rights, is all that discussion that we had the 30 years before we finally put it into a charter, is that appropriate for the online world? And do we need to actually look again to check to see whether the human rights activities and laws that we have are actually relevant online? And so the challenge I would put out to you is we'd be interested in forming a joint group with you, a UK-US group, to work through whether, in fact, that is the case. And I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Well, Excuse me, I have a cold today, so this is going to be interesting. This is the best my voice has been in like 3 weeks. And I guess I'd like to start out by saying, you know, last year when we sat on this panel, several of us were on the panel. Last year it was a very interesting discussion, and I would say it was probably just the beginning of that discussion. A lot has changed over the last year, much for the good. And I think we're at if we look historically at the roadmap of IT, we're at a very interesting place. There's a lot of promise with cloud computing as it exists today. In fact, there's been a number of surveys done that have recently come out in the net that talk about, you know, if you were to survey, say, everybody in this room and ask them, you know, are they planning sometime in the future to adopt cloud computing, whether it be for their personal information, whether it be consumer-based or enterprise-based, probably everybody would raise their hand. But if you ask them, have they or do they plan to do so in the next year, it's about 1%. So we have a little dilemma there, and most of this is because of the security, privacy, and trust issues that people feel when they put their data and their personal information up on the cloud. I also want to say that I am probably the only one on the panel that does not have a legal background. I'm actually a technologist, so spare me when you ask legal questions. But if I had to break it down into several different buckets, I would break it down into obviously privacy concerns. And when we think about privacy, I think about them in three different ways. I think about them from a government perspective, kind of big brother. There's been a lot of news recently about governments looking at data that happens to be available on the net and things like censorship, for example, the issues going on in China. Then there's the provider themselves, the service provider themselves having access to this data. And then obviously the bad guys. We're basically building vaults, very large vaults of data that are extremely attractive with all that personal identifiable information up there. Right, how do we protect that? You know, obviously we can think of the physical protection of the data centers themselves, but more importantly from a cybersecurity perspective. Right, and how does policy need to be changed to be able to adopt the appropriate rules to make sure that there's enough deterrent for those bad guys? Then I would say the next thing is just security in general. When people talk about cloud computing, it's when we talk about security, we're not really starting over again. In for all intents and purposes, we're going to add on to some of the best practices that the industry has developed over time with the on-premise solutions that we have. But what we will see, you know, is that when you move into the cloud, and especially from a consumer perspective, you know, I bank all the time. I bank online with Bank of America. I have no idea how they secure my information, right? But I trust them. The same goes for, you know, Microsoft or Google or any of the major providers for consumer information today. What I think needs to happen there is there needs to be a lot more transparency into that process, some of which will be self-governed by the industry themselves, but some of which may be able to be governed by some government policy, right? And what that policy looks like is everybody's question. But there probably is some analogy there, some way that we can do that. And then finally, the jurisdictional issues, right? With data flowing between data centers, between states, between governments around the world, how do we deal with those jurisdictional issues? Right? Is this some type of, you know, it could be a political nightmare. We think about, you know, the UN or the State Department getting involved and trying to have a multinational group that comes up with treaties and things of that sort to be able to create the laws. What will probably most likely happen, at least in the beginning, is that there'll be unilateral agreements between individual countries, right, to be able to handle the things like what happens if my data lives, I'm a U.S. citizen, but my data happens to reside in Canada or Mexico or better yet, you know, in the U.K. How do you handle those types of laws? And with that, I look forward to a very interesting discussion on the topic.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Roger. Good morning. There are some seats up front here, and since I'm talking, I welcome you to walk in front of me while I'm talking, if you want to take a seat, in case anybody's hesitating about, there we go, great.
Over on this side, too, there are more seats.
Yeah, there's a bunch of seats.
Back. Thank you for pointing that out, Jim.
That's only so you can make more room. Dan, come on up front. Make more room for people coming in. Jonah, great. Okay. You know, one of my personal mottos in terms of thinking about policy issues and about policymaking generally, and I think it's a generally applicable model, is think comprehensively, act incrementally. And I think this applies to how we sort of approach the issues associated with cloud computing. Roger has already sort of brought us down into one increment of the issue, which is specifically the consumer issues. But I think generally, whether you're talking about the consumer issues or the commercial issues, you should always at least start from the premise that much of the current law and policy and practice that we have developed does apply to the cloud and has relevance to the cloud. Mr. Wyatt referenced human rights. We do have a human rights framework, which in many of its terms and in many of its concepts is very broad and very comprehensive. And the consumer protection side, the FTC has over the past 10 years or so developed a body of almost common law of privacy and security using its unfair and deceptive authority. But there is a growing sense of what is the responsibility of a data custodian in terms of the representations that they make to consumers and living by those representations, as well as duties that go above and beyond even what's in the privacy policy on the security side. So clearly, an entity that collects data is responsible for protecting the security of that data within some parameters that are evolving, but nevertheless, the basic responsibility is there, and that clearly applies to the cloud as well. So I think in terms of addressing the policy issues generally and the privacy issues in particular associated with cloud computing, we almost have to do a gap analysis and ask ourselves, okay, what are the sort of special challenges presented by the cloud, and does the existing framework address it adequately? And if not, then what do we need to do to incrementally improve those areas of the law, fill those gaps, make sure that our framework, whether it's an intellectual property framework, a human rights framework, a consumer protection framework, match the realities. One area at CDT that we have identified is in the area of governmental access, one of the three areas of concern that Susie referenced. And the legal framework, as some of you know, is the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which on the one hand does clearly apply to the cloud. In ECPA terms, a provider of cloud computing services is statutorily defined as a provider of remote computing services, a term that in some degree was developed to address Ross Perot's EDS back in 1986 and the sending of payroll processing information to EDS and its processing and its return. But the definition in the statute is quite adequate to cover both the commercial as well as the consumer-facing cloud computing services. Unfortunately, as a result of sort of some compromises and the understandings that were then existent in 1986 when Congress adopted ECPA, it did not provide very high protection to data stored in the cloud, including private data. So the emails that we all now store a decade worth, most of us have at least, the photographs, the documents, the health records, all of this data that is stored in the cloud is accorded second-class status compared to the data that's stored locally. And data actually moves from one category to another, not depending upon its sensitivity, but depending upon how old it is and whether it's been read or unread and whether the service provider accesses it for providing security-related functionality or advertising-based services, et cetera. And so we've been working at CDT with a number of companies and privacy advocates and sort of ECPA groupies, I guess you would call us, and have developed a set of recommendations, which we are reaching the final status of. I talked about them last year, in fact. I talked about the beginning of the process last year. And we're now at the tail end of this phase of the process, and we'll soon be going public, but it's that then itself starts yet another whole process of really talking about extending the Fourth Amendment concept, regardless of platform, regardless of business model. Right now, you know, whatever you have stored on your laptop, fully protected by the Fourth Amendment. On the other hand, if through your laptop or through your handheld, you're accessing the same document, the same content, but from a remote server, that data is not protected. It's available to the government with a mere subpoena. And as I say, subpoena is Latin for no judge has ever seen this. Subpoenas are issued in blank to the FBI agents who fill them in. So it's a long, long process. Perhaps Mr. Wyatt was optimistic in saying it would be 18 months, I think I heard you mention. I think we know what the touchstone is. The touchstone is that sort of core Fourth Amendment concept that there's a certain core of privacy. In 1967, the Supreme Court extended that to a telephone. In 1986, Congress extended it to electronic communications. Now we've got this storage revolution to deal with, and it's time for that law to catch up in that regard as well.
Very interesting.
Thanks. Chuck?
Thanks so much, and I'd like to thank State of the Net organizers for inviting me here today. This is a great conference and a great panel. The focus of the law school over the past year has been on broadband policy, specifically policies that will spur broadband adoption and remove barriers to greater broadband adoption in core demographics and sectors of the economy. Our initial focus has been on, in terms of demographics, senior citizens and people with disabilities. Our initial focus in terms of sectors has been on government, the healthcare sector, the energy sector, and the education sector. We recently prepared a report working with staff at the FCC that identified across these six demographics and sectors some 60 barriers to broadband adoption. So that's really sort of the angle that I'm looking at the cloud computing issue from. And in our opinion, cloud computing really has the potential to spur broadband adoption if the policies relating to the cloud computing regime are right. So why is it important in the broadband context? Well, it's really important from, a cost or quantitative angle, and then also from a qualitative angle. So without going into the details of cloud computing, everyone in here is probably very well versed and expert in that arena. It delivers a number of cost benefits to, especially to enterprises and institutions. I mean, it enables these entities to engage and deliver, manage their data and deliver services much more cost-effective manner than they could if they didn't have access to the cloud. Qualitatively, it really sort of it has the potential to enhance the quality of services that are delivered. In the healthcare arena, for example, cloud computing can enable a very cost-effective, rich, real-time use of electronic health records that can be used in a way that enhance patient care, that enhance the services provided by healthcare professionals. So it's important. Cloud computing offers the potential to really deliver this a robust, rich set of real-time in-home monitoring services, for example, for people with disabilities, senior citizens, et cetera. So it's important to individuals. We all use it. If we're managing photos on Shutterfly, that's cloud computing in a sense. If we're using Google Docs or eFax, that's, we're cloud computing. But it really is this sort of important now and potentially exponentially important asset for businesses and institutions. And sort of the area of cloud computing from the law school standpoint raises three core policy issues. And the first hits on a question we were asked to address, how do we handle sort of personally identifiable how should personally identifiable information be handled? And just call that the first issue of privacy. And there are so many proposals and issues and ideas, you know, on the table and being discussed by various working groups. But it seems that that any privacy regime would have three core components. One would be a set of standardized rules, a model code of sort that would apply across cloud computing regimes so that a consumer that is using perhaps this robust Google cloud computing system or a Microsoft system or some other provider sort of has this common understanding of how their information will be used or protected. That is not going to vary by the provider. I think from a consumer standpoint, that's important. From a policymaker and a regulator standpoint, it's important because it provides some certainty. You don't want to have to look at a set, 50 pages of rights and responsibilities and rules every time you might use a service. So standard rules is one component of that. Transparency is another component. What the rules and rights are just need to be simplified and made crystal clear to the consumer, whether it's a big button on the homepage of the service that you're using or some other mechanism. And keeping in mind, your enterprises have been engaging in cloud computing probably for years. Your individuals are doing it more so now. So the level of sophistication of the user, whether it's an individual or an enterprise, maybe comes into play. And then a third factor that I think policymakers, congressional staffers, folks who are looking at this issue should consider is this issue of opt-in or opt-out. Are we opting into having our information shared for advertising purposes with third parties? Do we have to opt into that, or do we have to opt out of that? And that should just be made clear to the consumer. Two other core policy areas I think that are implicated. The second one is the issue of standards. Do we have standards sort of across this cloud computing network or enterprise, for example, or do we have our organizations, institutions, providers providing proprietary services? And I'll just give you a simple example, eFax versus MyFax. I've used both. eFax uses a very proprietary system. It's difficult to access your faxes after you have canceled your eFax service. MyFax uses more of an open standard. They communicate sort of all the faxes you receive in an Adobe format. So that's just for an individual or small business, those issues are important. And I think you're going to have different interests here. The public interest might say we need open standards across this enterprise. The proprietary interest of companies that are driving innovation and investing may say, well, hey, you know what? We're providing certain valuable services here. Maybe there's an interest. Maybe we need to be able to lock in something. My own personal view is the more we can have open standards across this, the better. But that's a discussion that providers, policymakers, users have to have. And then the third area is finally net management. And there's a lot of sort of discussion right now about how the network should be managed, what should be the net neutrality rules, et cetera. And I think that policymakers and regulators need to take a step back, and they need to really sort of focus on, all right, what is the core problem that we're trying to address with these proposed rules? I personally think that there can be some serious unintended consequences of an aggressive net management regime. You know, as a policymaker, if you're asked a question at some point in time when there might be congestion in the network, and you'll always have it, you will always have congestion in the network, even if you have a pipe as big as this room, you'll have congestion at some point. At that point in time, how do we want to treat a simultaneous download of videos over a program versus video relay between two deaf people? If at some point in time there might be conflict between an in-home real-time monitoring of senior citizen with disability or some other type of traffic, email traffic, what do we want to prioritize? So I think we need to just take a step back and let innovators continue to innovate some solutions to these issues and not be so quick to impose a rigid set of internet management rules. I think if we do that, we risk stifling some of the innovation that could otherwise occur. Thank you.
Thank you.
Perry.
Thank you. My name is Harry Wingo. I'm a policy counsel in Google's DC office, where I focus on cloud computing issues, among other things. Cloud represents a fundamental shift in how users are able to enjoy, use the internet, because what you're doing is you're moving from a model where your computer is like a box for your digital effects, if you will. And then you can move from that to, with great broadband connections, you can actually start using remote servers, essentially data centers, that are provided by many other providers. So you're going from a box model to a door. And this new door is opening up on so many more possibilities, possibilities that have implications for innovation, for security, actually. We feel that absolutely there are questions about security and privacy for the cloud, but you can't forget the status quo. If you've got the box model where once you connect a broadband connection to your computer, you're open and vulnerable to a lot of attacks. And in fact, now, if you look at security by that model, you have to keep up with patches. Sometimes it can take a sophisticated business over a month to make corrections, whereas if you've got security at scale, so to speak, with cloud, you've got other options. But on collaboration, this is a very important point for cloud computing that matters not only to users but for businesses, small and big, and for government, in fact. So with broadband connections and cloud, you're opening up more opportunities to leverage computing power, processing power, data storage that's not been available before. How many people here have email service online? Who uses Hotmail? Raise your hand. Anybody use Yahoo? Gmail? Anybody use? Okay, so I see a lot of hands. So we definitely got more than 1% of the room that's using email services, and guess what? You're on the cloud. If you use the online banking, you're already in cloud computing. So this is a transition that we're in the middle of right now. But I do agree we have to address some of the concerns, but we can't lose sight of the vision. And part of the vision of this is going to revolutionize the way that we do computing. No longer are you tied to one device, one machine, and you have the option for a lot of collaboration, a lot of innovation to happen, because you don't now have to be a business that builds your own servers. You may not even have to hire your own IT professionals. You can turn to cloud providers and immediately start up applications. And it's absolutely essential. This is something that Chuck mentioned about not being locked in. I think it's very important. EFAX and MIFAX, you're really talking about open protocols in addition to standards. And Google's cloud approach is that we want people to develop programs on top of our cloud. This is important because the right to tinker, the right to actually move forward, is something that's fundamental for the development of the Internet. If we go back to a model, let's look at where we came from on the Internet. This is really interesting. As far back as the 60s, people were envisioning using mainframes and having dumb terminals, if you will. And regulators at that point were concerned about options available to consumers and the businesses. And they thought, you know, maybe we should make sure that someone like IBM is in a good place compared to AT&T for providing services. But then the way this progressed is we had these digital boxes that had all these functions on it, your computer. You had storage. You stored all your files, most of them. And you really had intermittent or bursty access to the web. Broadband changes everything. Now you can not only have your computer, you can have a smartphone, any device. And the prices of these devices are going to fall because eventually the vision of where this is going, you'll be able to use any number of things to access the Internet. And not just the Internet, but these data centers where all of a sudden a Google data center is your computer or a Microsoft data center or Amazon or Salesforce. And as we move to this, it's important, though, again, on privacy. All of the companies are taking a look at privacy, but I think an important thing to remember is that this is nascent. This is all developing. Absolutely, the government should look at this, but when it comes to cloud computing and making sure this advances as swiftly as possible with all the benefits and the well-being of consumers in mind, I think the government should clear the road, not pave it. And so that means absolutely look at these things, but the government wants to help. There's two things. One thing is absolutely on Fourth Amendment. Jim is talking about a very important point on ECPA reform. If you've got your digital effects, so to speak, are out there in the cloud, your concept of what it means to have Flickr photos or to have your email stored, or if you're working on docs on Google or Microsoft or Adobe, you, I think, wouldn't want to share those with the world. Some things you may want to share. For example, if you've got a Facebook page and you haven't set certain settings and it's okay for you to be out there. But I think you really are looking at this as something that you have control over, and there's a reason we have passwords. But we have to have the concepts of regulation and what applies catch up with technology. And that's a very important point, because right now I think ECPA reform and moving forward with this effort, and we're working with CDT as is Microsoft, I think this is really important to clarify what our rights are in the cloud and really just catch up to what people's idea of protection out there in the cloud should be. The other thing the government is doing is government is looking at cloud in their own right for how they can streamline their operations, take advantage of collaboration, save money. The government doesn't make sense to have so many duplicative facilities, servers. You hear about private cloud. That's one approach. Some people may want to take it, but you're losing some of the benefits of cost savings and even energy savings and efficiency if you build a cloud for each government agency, so to speak, or if each company does virtualization and goes to a specific provider and doesn't share out there in the cloud. So I think transparency is important here, and this is something that Google does. We have gone through an auditing process, SAS 70 Type 2. We're also part of the safe harbor for the EU. And when we think that all of these things have international implications as well, you're going to have transborder data flows. But we can't forget that, again, you've got the private sector working these things out. Some will be through contracts. But the more open these things are, if you don't lock people in, that's another important point for cloud. Ask yourself, am I dealing with a cloud provider that is not trying to capture all of my data and make sure that I can't move on to another option? Google's absolutely against that. We have something called the Data Liberation Front. We want you to be able to move out of our cloud if you want to go to another cloud. But the reality of this is that when you decide to get online and use your cloud, you'll have any number of options. You may use Amazon for one thing. You may use Microsoft for another. You may go to YouTube or use something that Google has for another aspect of the cloud. So this is going to have a lot of impact on consumers, give you more options. You have powerful computing resources. And then I think we again need to look at these important questions about privacy, about how we can reform ECPA, but let's not lose sight of the fact that this is just innovation that's moving forward, and the market is going to have a role to play as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we'll open for questions from the floor in just a minute. Let me begin by asking if any of the panelists have questions that they would like to pose to other panelists or comments that they'd like to make on what anyone else on the panel has. Yes, Derek.
I think as each country tries to get its cloud computing, as I would say, philosophy resolved, What do we then do if there's tension between, say, the EU and America, or America and Canada, or America and Mexico, or you get the drift? So where would we take that argument? Because most of the bodies, if I go through them, the IMF, the World Bank, the United Nations, the WTO, where do we locate this discussion for the global citizen? I'm struggling to know where we're going to have these discussions in 2 years' time. So did the panel have a view?
I think Derek's question again is, how do you fit a global network of networks with everyone, consumers, constantly crossing borders in the storage of their data with a world that's made up of territorial jurisdictions? Any comments on that?
I think at some point we would have to draw a distinction between the individual customer and maybe the enterprise customer. But in the legal arena, this type of issue comes up and is handled via choice of law provisions, dispute resolution provisions. So I think, at some point, let's assume that there is some uniform set of rules that might apply or something close to uniform, and you've got an enterprise customer that knows the entity with which it's engaging in a cloud computing relationship. I think you just have to spell that out very clearly so that the parties know what their rights and responsibilities are. I think, for example, if you're dealing with individual customers as a matter of public policy, I think we would have to have some protection against an individual customer being sort of subject to rights and responsibilities of a foreign nation when they're dealing with an entity in the United States, and they think that, you know, they're dealing with Bank of America, for example. I think that they've got to have sort of rights and responsibilities that are governed by U.S. law in an appropriate forum. It's not an easy answer, but I think if you divided up enterprise versus individual, and you divided up choice of law and dispute resolution, you can at least tackle some of those issues for some of the customers.
Derek, one other comment. You are no doubt aware that under the auspices of the UN, there have been discussions going on for a decade on choice of law and applicable law on internet and e-commerce transactions. I think what makes the discussion about cloud computing different from that which has occurred over the past decade is that for almost all of the time of these discussions, the subject has been considered exotic. The subject has been considered sort of rare and unusual, and it has been generally assumed that we're talking about less than 1% of the consumers who are actually conducting transactions across borders. So we can take a few decades to figure out the answer for that small, and they're fairly sophisticated, well-off, tiny proportion. What's changed is obviously the percentage of consumers who are acting across borders.
Well, just put a point on that. The majority of Facebook's 350 million members are outside the United States.
Well, good point.
Perfect example.
If you just look at the moment in cyber terrorism, where your Pentagon's been with our Ministry of Defense for the last 2 days in Whitehall, well, clearly, you know, that is the next fear. So where do we take it? I don't get an answer, really, about where we take it in the world. And my instinct more and more is it's time we upgraded the G20. And that's if you look at the G20 structure, although there are technology ministers, they never have a main meeting. It's always at the margins, and it's always between G20 meetings. It's not seen as Premier League in the discussions. Cloud computing makes it imperative that technology is put on that agenda every time there's a G20. But I don't get a buzz that politicians understand that, and certainly not the leaders.
But I think the only way to make it doable is going to be to break it down that you know, there are different entities that are responsible for different parts of Internet governance. As Roger says, I mean, the Hague process focused specifically on the jurisdictional question. Others may know more about it. I think the bottom line is it has not produced very much clarity because of the difficulty of those issues. The cybercrime issue is its own issue and merits its own attention, and there may be a separate forum for that. So I think we will end up finding that we build the structure of various pieces, and that different international forums will have different pieces of it. I agree that all of the relevant forums need to be more acutely aware of the change that's occurring as a result of this technological development. But there's not going to be one single body. There will never be one single body.
No, I think I accept that. I don't have a – I mean, I'm sure the public –
Yeah, why don't we open – before I go to the floor and ask, I'd like to just pose one question to all – myself pose one question to all the panelists. Chuck mentioned something in his presentation which echoes an historic debate that's occurred within the information technology and much of the broader technology community. And I wanted to ask the panel, if I understood Chuck's concept correctly, I wanted to ask the panel if anyone cares to comment it or has a view on it. And one of Chuck's points was that by standardizing practices in the area of cloud computing, you will benefit the take-up of cloud computing. And of course, there are different ways to look at that proposition, one of which is that it is the competition between practices. It is the variety of practices which gives robustness, and the other way to look at it is that it is the standardization of practices which gives confidence. And without spending a lot of time going through the argument, it's not a new one. It's been around for 50 years at least, and I was wondering if anyone in the panel wanted to comment on Chuck's proposition.
So that's an, it's an interesting challenge. If you think about, you know, and this is not a new challenge just for the cloud. This has been a challenge that the IT industry has had for years. If you think about just sharing data between, you know, in a heterogeneous environment, which is really most computing environments today, right, we've come a long way, especially with the advent of web services. And I can remember, you know, 10 years ago, if you asked every major vendor, Microsoft, IBM, you know, the main players out there, Google, you know, everybody, are you going to support web services and, you know, the web services standards, XML, what, you know, what's your position on this? We all nodded our head and said yes, but we all had no idea what that was going to look like, you know, 10 years from now. And I think the same holds true now. I think that there is going to be some level of standardization, but hopefully not so much standardization that it's going to, you know, basically stop innovation. Right. It's, you know, if we can't innovate on top of the cloud, which is really the position that we're in yet today, they could actually stifle innovation. And so you're starting to see things, you know, we're building on top of standards that exist today, from, you know, whether it be REST, it be XML, whether it be, you know, security standards, things like ISO 27001, for example. And I think you'll start to see that the industry itself will start to self-govern by being, for example, we talked about security and being transparent. Microsoft is really trying to be as transparent as we possibly can about our security best practices and what we're doing in the cloud. And we are hoping things like maybe a security, some type of security document will become a standard that vendors actually provide to their end users so they can make better informed decisions, whether they're making those decisions as a consumer or as an enterprise. Right? On, should I put my data in this cloud? Should I trust Bank of America or should I trust Microsoft with my payroll information? And can I publish, can industry work together to get some type of standardization around that and then build on those standards to incorporate cloud, right, and the things that need to grow and as the cloud grows?
I just add on to what Susan was saying that absolutely you want to have development happen in the marketplace. There's an old story here we've seen in the internet. And this is the next phase of the internet. We have these things being worked out right now in the marketplace. What you don't want to happen is get confused about the difference between protocols and standards. And as these things start, taking an Amazon or Microsoft or Google, we're going to have some element of proprietary systems. But the question to ask is, are you able to let people then have an open approach or have protocols that allow folks to build on top of your cloud offerings? And then are those cloud offerings able to interact? So if I take my Nexus One or my smartphone and I want to open an application, I may go to one application provider in one instance and then turn around to another. It should be easy and seamless for consumers. You just want it to work. And absolutely, you want to be secure and you want to know that you're protected. But these are things that the market's going to work out. And the government should look at this with an eagle eye and make sure that there's no barriers, there's nothing going on with competition and the networks. Broadband, we absolutely have to, you know, have an open internet to make this flourish and thrive. So watching how this develops, let's definitely keep an eye on it. But these things are happening right now in cloud the same way that you saw interoperability and protocols worked out on the internet.
Thank you. Before we go to questions from the floor, let me ask if you have a question to please come up to the microphone so we can record it. Identify yourself. If you have an affiliation you care to share with us, do so. And to the extent possible, direct your question to somebody on the panel. Yes, sir. Jerry, you want to introduce yourself? And
Jerry Berman. For today, I'm Internet Education Foundation. Jim Dempsey is Center for Blockchain Technology, which I have some relationship with. And I also was there to try and help write ACRA, so I've been around a long time. I think, as Jim pointed out and others pointed out, that the concept of privacy protection was based on an end-to-end network, that we would go from place A to place B, and we could protect privacy at the end, where I have a property right. That's my computer, person's papers of the fact protected under the Fourth Amendment, extended by Congress. Harry said, we are moving, this is a fundamental transformation,
yep,
to say I am now moving myself into the cloud. And you talked about my cloud. Is it my cloud? Do I have a property right in the cloud, yep, in the server space, yep, which I'm using on Gmail? That's a very important distinction which has Fourth Amendment implications and also privacy implications, which give me very strong protection. Now, I give those up when I give my information to a bank because I share it with a third party. Mm-hmm. What Google is promising me is that my end-to-end transaction is now going through to the other end, but that somehow or other it's mine. And I think that the law has to clarify whether netizens have a property right in the cloud.
Jerry, that's a great question. I would actually turn it around a little bit, and Jim made reference to, I think, the Katz case, where you had, you know, let's look back at the founders. Their intention on this is that you'd be secure in your personal effects and you don't have unreasonable searches. So you have both the expectation of privacy, and then is it reasonable? As far as the property issue, I'll set that aside because it's really about your understanding of what's reasonable and then also your perception of whether what you have is safe. So let's take a look at your email accounts. I think everyone raised their hands at different times, but most everybody in the room has an email account out there, so you're all in the cloud. You may have things that go back, very personal communications, that go back several years. And I think if the founders were here, if George Washington had email, he would say, you know, I don't think the government should be going through that. But we have to update that concept. And so there's lots of jurisprudence. You know, Supreme Court has asked questions about containers, if I'm on a bus, if it's not, you know, near me, someone, police officer comes by and feels it, if I'm flying over someone's backyard and I look down. But I think a password, I think the fact that you go through steps to open it up, what is the concept of a digital container? What do your digital effects mean? This is why we need to upgrade, you know, our concepts in ECPA. That's why it's so important that we upgrade this, and I think that we need to push for the side of having protections in the cloud. Otherwise, you're going to have these questions. Courts are working it out, but the more that we can do to create certainty on this, that's very important. I'd like to point out one other thing, too, about security and this whole issue. I mentioned that your computer now is more like a box, and cloud computing means it becomes more like a door. What's interesting about your computer now is that when you connect it to a broadband, you put in a broadband connection, it turns out that actually bad guys probably have more access to your information than the government does. But on the cloud, it's the reverse at this point.
Jerry, just, you know, the property concept is a very powerful one, obviously. I think Harry is correct in saying that we need to think of it, though, as Katz did, the Fourth Amendment protects people, not places. And that the property at issue here is not physical property, clearly. And it's not the question of physical control. Now, the property concept, again, is rhetorically powerful. I do think it has some limitations. And that was illustrated by Facebook's stumble when it rewrote its privacy policy. And the privacy policy said, you own your information on Facebook. You hereby give us an irrevocable, worldwide, license-free, transferable license to use your data as we see fit. So I own it. I own my data, but I just gave away that bundle of rights in my data. Now, Facebook reeled that one back in, but that's the danger of the property concept, which is you click yes, and suddenly that which you own has now been licensed to somebody else for them to do with it what they wish through the terms of service. So you've got to go beyond, you've got to go much, much deeper than the question of who owns it.
Well, I want to, just my final comment. I think comprehensively too, Jeremy, and act incrementally.
I learned it from you.
But I think that it may not be the right concept, but for the netizen to understand,
I agree. That's why it's so powerful.
Property here, physical or not, that they are moving somewhere and that they care about it. I think that's the only consciousness-raising thing to say that will focus the consumer mind on what is going on here and just raise some fundamental questions about it.
And there's to follow up on this. I mean, an additional issue is how far would that right extend? We've got servers out there, and in the non-cloud world, businesses have document retention policies. They have the right to shred confidential business information, proprietary information. Individuals have rights to, you know, get rid of the letters to their spouse that they don't want out there. I mean, there are rights to do this. So what happens when you cancel, for example, your Gmail account? Or what happens when you move that information back off? Are there copies of it that are in backup on the servers? I mean, and these are real issues. We've studied sort of the document retention policies of a number of organizations, and it's not clear to the consumer. It's not clear that, for example, if you decide, I no longer want this information on the cloud, that information is not, in fact, still on the cloud. It may be in backup servers. So I think that's an issue that has to be worked out. When it's gone, it needs to be gone. And as a technical matter, can that be done? Can that be done on the servers, or is it always there? And of course, you'll have the consumer that comes back and says, oh, I didn't really mean to take all that away. I need that back. And then, so there are issues there. And I think we just have to inform the consumer, and we let the consumer know this is different. If you put your proprietary business records online, if you put your business strategies online, if you put personal information online, there is, in fact, a risk that when you take it out of the cloud, it is still there, subject to some disclosure or discovery.
And I'd like to comment on that. So if you think about this, in the Department of Defense world, I'm not sure how many people live in that world, they actually have some very stringent rules about data that actually gets on just behind the firewall onto servers. If, for example, a secure email were to be on a non-secure network and that was found, you basically have to literally destroy the hard drive. Which is an interesting challenge when you start to talk about even private clouds. Right? It's not very economical and kind of defeats the whole purpose of the cloud. But the comment I'd also like to make is take that to yet another level. When you're on the net, people know actually where you're at. Right? There's all kinds of information that's being tracked about you if you go to a search engine. Right? What are the rules and regulations, and how does this data that you don't really even understand, you might not even know what that data is, it's being collected about you. Right. How do we handle, how do you handle things like that, and how do you do that in such a way that doesn't hinder innovation? And so, we made some announcements about how we're trying to handle that in Bing, and we also have the ability for you to say, click on the browser inside of Bing and say, I don't want to have targeted, for example, advertisements given to me or that information tracked about me. And, some of these things, I don't think we're at the space or the place where we've defined all those, but those are definitely things that I think need to be included in that same discussion.
Just a quick point. Google absolutely believes consumer education is critical, and we take steps often to let people know what our policies are with regards to getting rid of your data, to how we store it, to what we have, information we have about you. But also on the security side, we've taken steps like instituting SSL or HTTPS to make sure that when you're transmitting data, it's secure. Also, if you're using our browser, for example, we've got something if you're about to click on an unsecure site, we'll let you know. It's one thing we can do with cloud computing. We have an idea of, like, where you don't want to go. It's equivalent if you're in a city you don't know and the taxi cab driver's saying, I know you asked me to drop you off at this alley, but I wouldn't go down there. People have been killed there. So, I mean, we think that you absolutely have to be informed. We're taking steps constantly to make sure consumer education's out there, but that's something everyone in the industry needs to do.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Well, yes. By way of full disclosure, I'm Kerry Hinton, and I'm a regulator. Chuck knows me. I'm with the D.C. Public Service Commission, so I'm probably a bit of a pariah here amongst freedom folks.
Not at all.
Last night, I'm going to tell you a little story. Last night, my wife and I are sitting on the sofa watching one of the primetime, one of the major networks, and lo and behold, we see an advertisement for an unnamed company, but it's none of the major ones represented here or that has been mentioned in the discussion today. But a new company that relatively new to probably most people, a new company is running primetime ads asking people to sign up for their, I should say, contact them to obtain their file backup systems. It's all encrypted. Trust us, it's great. It's
I saw this.
be terrific for you, so on and so forth. how does the public ensure that is actually going to happen? Isn't there a step that needs to go beyond just industry self-regulation to protect the public, to ensure that that cloud of data doesn't end up going over to, whether it be Switzerland, which we've had problems in obtaining data from the Swiss banks, or worse yet, if that cloud doesn't go over to the tribal mountains of Pakistan or Afghanistan and start raining down data there? Isn't there a time, whether it be now or soon or ever, that there be governmental regulation of at least that segment of the industry to ensure that there are adequate...
Yeah, but wait a second. It's a good question, but that company is regulated. That company cannot act in an unfair and deceptive way. That company cannot fail to adequately protect the security of that information. And we have a Federal Trade Commission, and we have 50 state attorney generals and 50 state departments of consumer protection. Now, you can say...
It's after... You're talking about after-the-fact remedy.
Well...
And what I'm suggesting is prior...
The fact that, there are significant companies of significant size that are under 25-year consent decrees with the FTC has certainly affected the policies and practices of those companies not subject to those orders.
Correct. Members of the public at that point.
Correct. And you've got...
You don't say to doctors, you can give out drugs without having to be board certified, certified, whether it be board certified or not. You don't say that you can give out drugs that haven't been approved by the FDA. But here you are, you're telling are companies that should be able to employ people that we have no idea whether they've got criminal records. We have no idea whether they, in fact, have the technical capabilities that they say they have. We have no idea whether they have the encryption services that they advertise that they say they have until after the damage has been done. Then someone can go to an attorney, start a class action lawsuit, or go to an AG's office to file complaints and go through that.
I think for the sake of time, I'm going to have to ask. Your question
is very clear.
I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up.
That's a good point.
Carrie, just real quickly, I think it would be useful, you can draw a distinction between the enterprise customer and the individual. Again, I think the enterprise sort of has the savviness and would investigate that. For the individual, I mean, I think it's a worthwhile discussion to have and figure out if there are options on the table amongst sort of all the players now that can sort of get to the point of providing more information, protecting people. I would have to say if I saw that just as myself before I ever signed up with anybody to disclose my information, I would first probably hop on Google and do a search and really do this investigation and see what's out there. So I think at some point we have to have the person watching that sort of making an informed decision. Is this right for me? Do I do it? And why? The reality is, though, you've got people sort of who will sign up quickly for, Google Docs or a Microsoft data, and they're safe in those instances. It's when you sort of get this fly by night. I personally don't know, though, given sort of all that we've seen about sort of government working in an innovative market, if ex ante regulation by government is the way to go there. We've got a lot of rules on the books to deal with it ex post. I think we have the discussion, but we don't necessarily put rules in place right now that may be outdated, the minute the next company comes onto the scene.
And, Carrie, that's a fair question. That's something government should be asking. But also don't forget the status quo situation where you have computers, all your information stored locally. As soon as you attach to a broadband connection, you might as well be part of an insecure cloud. And so that's a system that's going on as well. Some of the very same questions could be asked there if you go down that road. But I think, again, to the last point made, the private sector is moving forward with solutions on these things, but you're doing a great job asking exactly what regulators should. I'm a son of D.C., by the way, too. So, all right, thank you.
For the sake of time, I'm going to have to try to bring to a conclusion with that. And a couple of administrative things. First, lunch has begun.
And I would encourage all of you to continue this this discussion in the ballroom where we will begin lunch in a few moments. And for those who are interested in this subject as well, that in this room this afternoon after lunch will be a discussion of online privacy. If you would join me in thanking the panelists for their contribution and discussion. Thank you all for coming.